Well, it is rare that we get to consider the story of the Magi on a Sunday, and rare that we get to sing We Three Kings of Orient Are, which we'll do a little later. But here we are on the 12th day of Christmas, the eve of the Epiphany, day on which we remember that even as a child, the significance of Jesus, marked by the men from the mysterious East, the significance of Jesus is for the whole world. And they underline the significance of this child, and prefiguring, in a sense, the story that is to come, they underline it with their gifts of gold, a gift for a king, and frankincense, a gift for a great high priest, and myrrh, prefiguring the embalming that will come before Jesus' death. You've probably heard the old joke that had the Magi been women, things would have been different. They would have asked for directions. They would have arrived on time. They would have helped birth the child. They would have changed diapers. They would have brought practical gifts, for God's sake, and they would have brought world peace. Now, in fact, we don't know how many people there were. In the Eastern Church, they honor 12 Magi. Our tradition, Western tradition of three, comes from the number of gifts that were offered. We're probably right about their gender, based not only on the joke, but cultural norms. But in spite of our Franciscan creche scenes, there's no suggestion that the Magi came to a stable. More important was that they came to Bethlehem of Judea, not the seat of imperial power, but a place associated with the origin of the lineage of King David. And so, as we learn, an implicit threat to the powers of the day, a threat that will go on through this whole story. The tension begins here. They came sometime after the birth, indicated by the use of the word for young child rather than the use of the word infant, as we hear in Luke's gospel. It's a story that's deep in our tradition, deep in our imaginations. But sometimes we can find ways to hear it differently. Sage and Ruthie and Alice and I took a long road trip south over the past week. And in our plentiful car time, we listened to an NPR podcast called In the Dark, which examined the case of a man called Curtis Flowers, who was accused of executing 4 people in a furniture store in Winona, Mississippi. And he was convicted and sentenced to death in 6 separate trials, only to have each verdict overturned for one reason or another on every occasion by higher courts. Last month, the Supreme Court of the United States invalidated the most recent verdict on the basis that prosecutors had excluded black jurors on the basis of race. And Flowers is out of prison on bail for the first time in 23 years, but he is awaiting his 7th trial. Double jeopardy apparently does not apply because he's not technically been acquitted of these crimes. And the prosecutor in this case continues to seek the death penalty for him. It's an extraordinary story in its own right, and the podcast recounts the journalist examination of the case in exacting detail. Now, I bring it up this morning because I was struck by how easy it is for us to get wedded to a single reading of a story. And so there are many people involved in this case, on the prosecutor's side and the family, the victims, families, and so on, who say things like, I'm 100% certain he did it. There's no doubt in my mind he did it. I'd execute him himself, I'm so sure he did it. Now, they'd not heard the painstaking work of the reporter, Madeleine Baran, to create what seems to me to be reasonable doubt, but it's not allowable for the prosecution, who are wedded to their understanding that this guy did it and he deserves to die. Doubt is not something they can contemplate. And once again, all these sincere, probably God-fearing white men are determined to execute a black prisoner. Now, I'm neither judge nor jury, of course, but I believe in the rule of law, and I hope that Mr. Flowers, as with all accused people, can have a fair trial without preconceptions by those who will determine the way forward in this, or indeed any case. Hearing from all the witnesses and delving into even minute details is so important for justice to be done and justice to be seen to be done. I can't do anything about the Flowers case, and I'm guessing that's true for you too. But we can keep on with the spiritual work of checking our assumptions, testing our conclusions, our beliefs, and finding that life is richer for all of us, for everyone, when we do that work. So let's imagine setting aside our deep images of three crown-wearing royals, named by tradition as Caspar and Melchior and Balthazar, respectively kings of India and Persia and Arabia. And let's set aside these images of them kneeling alongside the shepherds, the Lucan shepherds in the stable. I'm not suggesting we ditch our traditions at all, but just see what we can see in this story without those layers of folklore around these three wise men. Now, Matthew doesn't call them kings. The kings in this story are Herod and Jesus, one fearful and scheming and violent, and the other an infant, vulnerable, but the embodiment of love. So the kings in the story are already in conflict, and it's going to continue throughout it. And what about the wise men? That might be harder because they're called wise. One commentator, Dr. Mark Allen Powell from Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Columbus, Ohio, has suggested that the wise men in the story, as contrasted with those other wise men who came to pay homage, the real people who thought they were the wise men are the chief priests and the scribes who advise Herod, but whose wisdom does not lead them to their Messiah. Their wisdom leads them to scheming and plotting. These are the really smart people. These are the people doing the head counts. These are the people who are reading the signs and saying, this is a problem, what can we do about it? But real wisdom, the story suggests, is exhibited by the Magi in their willingness to seek not their own honor, but to seek first wisdom. What's the first thing they do when they come into the house is they pay homage, even before they offer gifts. They're not trying to buy any favor. They offer worship, even kneeling before a woman, for crying out loud, and a child. They're finding God in the most extraordinary and unexpected place because they're willing to set aside whatever it is they're carrying to see and learn of new experiences, new possibilities. Now, if the Magi are in some sense a model for us who are outsiders to Jesus' own tradition, then there's something to be said for our striving to be aware of our own assumptions, our own prejudices, our own privilege, and being open to really understanding and appreciating the perspective of others. I thought again about this as last Friday we had a house guest, Emmanuel Bwata, who's dean of the Theological Seminary of Western Tanganyika in Tanzania. He's a scholar who's studied in America many times and was with us for a couple of nights. And we went together to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And as we had lunch after the visit, I thought about the Magi as we attempted to discuss, to really discuss lots of things in the exhibit. Said, we don't talk about race, we don't talk about difference, we don't talk about privilege in our schools and elsewhere. And I thought, well, goodness, we're having this conversation and we're attempting to discuss meaning of race and color and region and nationality. And I shared how long, with regard to Tanzania, it had taken me to realize that I was carrying assumptions about how we communicate. And so I assumed, as happens in here, is that we tend to tell the truth in the privacy of our own homes. And we tend to be much more careful in a public-facing way. And I assumed when we were having conversations with the bishop of Western Tanganyika, and that he was in agreement with us. And then we'd go out to a church and he'd say something completely different. What's going on here? And what was going on, it took me a while to learn, was that you wouldn't dream of disagreeing with your guest as a matter of hospitality. In that culture, in your own home, for goodness sake, disagreeing would be terrible. So I'd assumed that silence meant agreement. And then over here, we suddenly find he's saying something completely different. Whoa, what's going on? Well, my assumptions were what were getting in the way of a real useful conversation which could have happened in the office or somewhere else. And I learned something important about this cross-cultural reality that we have to somehow learn what it is we're seeing and hearing so that we can really see it and hear it. And that's a big spiritual task and a challenging one, and it comes up in our lives increasingly over and over and over. So turning into the new year, maybe leaning into a new year, I want to continue the work of the Magi and want to invite you to do it too, listening in humility to the currents of the universe, that we may see God's hand at work, God made manifest, an epiphany, in places that shed light on our own responsibility, our own privilege, our own assumptions, so that we can more faithfully and more truly see the hand of God at work in the world. The Magi foreshadow much of that is to come in the story of the babe of Bethlehem, and in a way they foreshadow the opening of new possibilities for each of us as we seek to follow Jesus. In our time of silence, I invite you to consider not so much a New Year resolution, but more what you want to work on in your spiritual life in the year to come. Maybe it's listening carefully to the experience of people whose stories are very different than our own. Maybe something else. In silence and in response to the gospel, let us pray.